This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Bridget Jones, Mad About the Boy by Helen Fielding. Read for you by Samantha Bond. Prologue. Thursday, 18th of April, 2013. 2:30 p.m. Talitha just called, talking in that urgent, let's be discreet but wildly overdramatic voice she always has. Darling, I just want to let you know that it's my 60th on the 24th of May. I'm not saying it's my 60th, obviously, and keep it quiet, because I'm not asking everyone. I just wanted you to keep the date free. I panicked. That would be great, I gushed unconvincingly. Bridget, you absolutely can't not come. Well, the thing is...
What?
It's Roxter's 30th birthday that night. Silence at the end of the phone. I mean, we probably won't still be together by then, but if we are, it would be... I tailed off.
I've just put no children on the invites.
He'll be 30 by then, I said indignantly.
I'm just teasing, darling. Of course you must bring your toy boy. I'll get a bouncy castle.
Back on air. Must run, love you, bye. Tried to turn on telly to see if Talitha had indeed, as so often, been calling me live on air during a film clip. Jabbed confusedly at the buttons, like a monkey with a mobile phone. Why does turning on a TV these days require 3 remotes with 90 buttons? Why? Suspect designed by 13-year-old techno geeks competing with each other from sordid bedrooms, leaving everyone else thinking they're the only person in the world who doesn't understand what the buttons are for, thus wreaking psychological damage on a massive, global scale. Threw remotes petulantly onto sofa, at which TV randomly burst into life, showing Talitha looking immaculate, one leg sexily crossed over the other, interviewing the dark-haired Liverpool footballer who has the anger management biting problem. He looked as if he wanted to bite Talitha, though for rather different reasons than on the pitch. Right, no need for panic. We'll simply assess pros and cons of Roxter Talitha party issue in calm and mature manner. Pros of taking Roxter to party. It would be terrible not to go to Talitha's. She has been my friend since our Sit Up Britain days, when she was an impossibly glamorous newsreader and I was an impossibly incompetent reporter. It would be quite funny to take Roxter, and also smug-making, because the 30th, 60th birthday thing would stop all that patronizing, pitying of single women of a certain age thing, like they're terminally stuck with their singleness, whereas single men of that age are snapped up before they've had time to draw up the divorce papers. And Roxter is so gorgeous and peach-like, thereby somehow denying reality of aging process on self. Cons of taking Roxter to party. Roxter is his own man, and would doubtless take exception to being treated as some sort of comedy or anti-aging device. Crucially, it might put Roxter off me, to be surrounded by old people at 60th birthday party, and make some sort of completely unnecessary point about how old I am, though of course am much younger than Talitha. And frankly, I refuse to believe how old I actually am. As Oscar Wilde says, 35 is the perfect age for a woman, so much so that many women have decided to adopt it for the rest of their lives. Roxter is probably having his own party, with young people squeezed onto his balcony, barbecuing and listening to 70s disco music with ironic retro amusement, and is thinking at this moment how to avoid asking me to the party in case his friends find out he is going out with a woman literally old enough to be his mother. Actually, possibly technically, with the advancement of puberty due to hormones in milk these days, grandmother. Oh, God, why did mind think such a thought? 3:10 p.m. Ah! Have got to pick up Mabel in 20 minutes and have not got rice cakes ready. Ah! Telephone! I have Brian Katzenberg for you. My new agent. Actual agent. But I would be beyond late for Mabel if I stopped and talked. Can I call Brian back later? I trilled, trying to smear pretend butter onto the rice cakes, stick them together and put them in a Ziploc with one hand. It's about your spec script. Just in a meeting. How could I be in a meeting and yet talking on the phone, saying I'm in a meeting? People's assistants are meant to say they're in a meeting, not the person themselves.
who is supposed to be unable to say anything because they're in a meeting. Set off on school run, feeling now desperate to call back and find out what the call was about. Brian has so far sent it to 2 production companies, both of whom have turned it down. But now, maybe a fish has bitten at the fishhook. Fought overwhelming urge to ring Brian back, claiming meeting had come to an abrupt end, but decided far more important to be on time for Mabel. And that's the sort of caring, prioritizing mother I am. 4:30 p.m. School run was even more chaos than usual, like Where's Wally picture of millions of lollipop ladies, babies in prams, white van men having standoffs with over-educated SUV mums, a man cycling with a double bass strapped to his back, and earth mothers on bicycles with tin boxes full of children in the front. Entire road was gridlocked. Suddenly, a frantic woman came running along yelling, "Go back! Go back! Come on! Nobody is helping here!" Realizing there had been a terrible accident, I and everyone else started rearing their cars crazily onto pavement and into gardens to make way for emergency services. Once road was clear, peered gingerly ahead for the ambulance bloodbath. But there was not an ambulance, just a very fancy woman flouncing into a black Porsche, then roaring furiously along the newly cleared road, a smug, be-uniformed small child next to her in the front seat. By the time I got to the infants' branch, Mabel was the only child left on the steps, apart from the last straggler, Thelonious, who was about to leave with his mum. Mabel looked at me with her huge, solemn eyes. "Come on, old pal," she said kindly. "We wondered where you'd got to," said Thelonious's mum. "Did you forget again?" "No," I said. The road was completely gridlocked.
"Mummy 51, Mabel suddenly burst out. "Mummy 51. She said she's 35, but she's really 51.
"Shh!" I responded to Thelonious's mother's stare. "Better run off and get Billy." Managed to get Mabel, still yelling "Mummy 51, into the car, leaning over in the traditional body-wrenching movement, which gets increasingly awkward with age, fastening the seatbelt by waddling my hand in the mess between the seat back and booster seat. Arrived at Billy's junior branch to see perfect Nicolette, the class mother. Perfect house, perfect husband, perfect children, only slight imperfection being name, presumably chosen by parents before invention of popular smoking substitute. Surrounded by a gaggle of junior branch mothers. Perfect Nicorette was perfectly dressed and perfectly blow-dried with a perfectly gigantic handbag. Sidled up panting to see if I could get the scoop on the latest area of concern, just as Nicolette flicked her hair crossly, nearly taking my eye out with the corner of the giant bag. "I asked him why Atticus is still in the football D's. I mean, Atticus has been coming home literally in tears, and Mr. Wallacker just said, 'Because he's rubbish, anything else?'" Glanced over at the area of concern, new sports teacher. Fit, tall, slightly younger than me, crop-haired. Rather like Daniel Craig in appearance. He was staring broodingly at a group of unruly boys, then suddenly blew a whistle and bellowed, "Oi, you lot, in the cloakroom now or I'll caution you." "You see," Nicolette continued, as the boys formed themselves into a shambolic line, attempting to jog back into school, shouting, "One, sir, two, sir," like startled bushmen recruited to form a spring uprising, while Mr. Wallacker blew his whistle ludicrously in time. "He is hot, though," said Fazia. Fazia is my favourite school mum, always having her priorities in place. "Hot, but married," snapped Nicolette, "and with children, though you wouldn't guess it." "I thought he was a friend of the headmaster," ventured another mum. "Exactly. Is he even trained?" said Nicolette.
"Mummy,"
looked round to see Billy, in his little blazer, dark hair tousled, shirt hanging out of his trousers.
"I didn't get picked for chess."
Those same eyes, those same dark eyes, stabbed with pain. "It doesn't matter about being picked or winning," I said, giving Billy a furtive hug. "It's who you are that counts."
"Of course it matters."
"Yeah, it was Mr. Wallacker.
He has to practice, he has to earn it.
As he turned away, distinctly heard him mutter, "The sense of entitlement amongst the mothers in this school defies belief."
"Practice," I said brightly. "Why, I'd never have thought of that. You must be terribly clever, Mr. Wallacker. I mean, sir."
He looked at me with his cold blue eyes. "What has this got to do with the sports department?" I continued sweetly.
"I teach the chess class."
"But how lovely.
Do you use the whistle?" Mr. Wallacker looked disconcerted for a moment, then said,
"Eros, get out of that flower bed now."
"Mummy," said Billy, tugging on my hand, "the ones that got picked get 2 days off school to go to the chess tournament."
"I'll practice with you."
"But, Mummy, you're rubbish at chess."
"No, I'm not. I'm really good at chess. I beat you."
"You didn't."
"I did."
"You didn't."
"Well, I was letting you win because you're a child," I burst out. "And anyway, it isn't fair because you have chess classes."
"Perhaps you could join the chess classes, Mrs. Darcy."
Oh, God. What was Mr. Wallacker doing still listening?
"There is an age limit of 7, but if we stretch that to mental age, I'm sure you'll be fine. Did Billy tell you his other news?"
"Oh," said Billy, brightening. "I've got knits."
"Knits?" I stared at him aghast, hand reaching instinctively to my hair.
"Yes, knits. They've all got them."
Mr. Wallacker looked down, a slight flicker of amusement in his eyes.
"I realise this will cause a national emergency amongst the North London Mumserati and their coiffeurs, but you simply need to knit-comb them. And yourself, of course."
Oh, God. Billy had been scratching his head recently, but I'd sort of blanked it as one thing too many to take on. Could feel my head starting to crawl as my mind cartwheeled. If Billy's got knits, then probably Mabel's got knits, and I've got knits, which means that Roxter has got knits.
"Everything all right?"
"Yes, no, super," I said. "Everything's fine, jolly good. Bye then, Mr. Wallacker." Walked away, holding Billy's and Mabel's hands, to hear a ping on my mobile. Hurriedly put on my glasses to read the text. It was from Roxter.
"How late were you this morning, my precious? Shall I hop on the bus tonight and bring round a shepherd's pie?"
"Cannot have Roxter coming over when we have to knit-comb everyone and wash all the pillowcases." Surely it is not normal to be thinking of an excuse to cancel your toy boy because the entire household has got knits. Why do I keep getting myself into such a mess? 5 p.m. We burst back into our terrace house with the usual jumble of backpacks, crumpled paintings, squashed bananas, plus a large bag of knit-combing products from the chemist, and clattered past the ground-floor lounge office, increasingly redundant apart from the sofa bed and empty John Lewis boxes, and down the stairs into the warm, messy basement kitchen sitting room where we spend all our time. I settle Billy to do his homework and Mabel to play with her Helvanians, Sylvanian bunnies, while I put on the spag bog. Now, I'm in total fug about what to text Roxter about tonight, and whether I should tell him about the knits. 5:15 p.m. Maybe not. 5:30 p.m. Oh, God. Had just texted, "Would love you to come, but have to work tonight, so better not," when Mabel suddenly sprang up and started singing Billy's least favourite song at him, when the phone rang. Lunged at it, just as Billy jumped up yelling, "Mabel, stop singing Jessie J!" And a receptionist's voice purred, "I have Brian Katzenberg for you. Could I possibly call Brian back in..." "Ba-bling, ba-bling," sang Mabel, chasing Billy round the table. "I have Brian on now. No, can you just..." "Mabel!" wailed Billy. "Stop it!"
"Shh! I'm on the phone."
"Hey!" Brian's brisk, cheery voice. "So, great news. Greenlight Productions want to take out an option on your script."
"What?" I said, heart leaping. "Does that mean they're going to make it into a film?"
Brian laughed heartily. "It's the movie business. They're just going to give you a small amount of money to develop it. And..."
"Mummy! Mabel's got a knife!"
I put my hand over the receiver, hissing, "Mabel, give me the knife now!" Hello? Hello? Brown was saying. Laura, I think we've lost Bridget.
No, I'm here, I said, flinging myself at Mabel, who was now hurtling after Billy, brandishing the knife.
They want to have an exploratory meeting on Monday at noon.
Monday? Great, I said, wrestling the knife off Mabel. Is the exploratory meeting like an interview?
Mummy!
Shh! I hustled the two of them onto the sofa and started struggling with the remotes.
They just have a few issues with the script they want to talk about before they decide to go ahead.
Right. Right. Suddenly felt hurt and indignant. A few issues with my script already. But what could they possibly be?
So remember, they're not going to...
Mummy! I'm bleeding!
Shall I call back in a while?
No, all fine, I said desperately, as Mabel yelled,
Call the ambulance!
You were saying?
They're not going to want a first-time writer who's difficult. You've got to find a way to go along with what they want.
Right, right, so not to be sort of a nuisance.
You got it, said Brian.
My brother's going to die, sobbed Mabel.
Is everything...
No, fine, super.
12 o'clock Monday, I said, just as Mabel shouted,
I've killed my brother.
Okay, said Brian, sounding nervous. I'll get Laura to email you the details.
6 p.m. Once the furore had been dampened, the minuscule snick on Billy's knee covered in a Superman plaster, black marks placed on Mabel's consequences chart, and Spag Bog placed in their stomachs, I found my mind flashing through multiple matters, like that of a drowning person, only more optimistic. What was I going to wear for the meeting? And was I going to win an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay? Didn't Mabel have an early finish on Monday, and how was I going to pick them up? What was I going to wear for the Oscar ceremony? And ought I to tell the Greenlight Productions team that Billy has got nits?
8 p.m. Nits found, 9. Actual insects, 2. Knit eggs, 7. Fiji. Just bathed the kids and knit-combed them, which turned out to be brilliant fun. Found 2 actual insects in Billy's hair and 7 eggs behind his ears, 2 behind one, and a magnificent crop of 5 behind the other. It's so satisfying seeing the little black dots appear on the white knit-comb. Mabel was upset, as she didn't have any, but cheered up when I let her knit-comb me to reveal that I didn't have any either. Billy was waving the knit-comb, crowing,
I got 7!
But when Mabel burst into tears, he sweetly put 3 of his into her hair, which meant we had to knit-comb Mabel all over again. 9:15 p.m. Kids are asleep. Wildly puffed-up re-meeting. I'm professional woman again and going to a meeting. I'm going to wear navy silk dress and get hair blow-dried, in spite of Mr. Bloody Wallacker's supercilious take on coiffures, and in spite of gnawing sense that increasing female blow-dry habit is turning women into those 18th or 17th century men who only felt comfortable in public situations when wearing powdered wigs. 9:21 p.m. Oh, though is it morally wrong to get a blow-dry when I may have undetectable knit eggs at the start of their 7-day cycle? 9:25 p.m. Yes, it is morally wrong. Maybe Mabel and Billy should not go to play dates either. 9:30 p.m. Also feel should tell Rockster truth about nits, as lies are bad in a relationship. But maybe in this case, lies better than lice. 9:35 p.m. Nits seem to be throwing up unfeasible number of modern moral dilemmas. 9:40 p.m.
Ah! Just went through entire wardrobe,
i.e. pile of clothes heaped on exercise bike, plus actual wardrobes, and cannot find navy silk dress. Have nothing to wear for meeting now. Nothing. How is it that have all these clothes stuffed into wardrobe, a navy silk dress is only one that can actually wear for anything important? Resolve in future. Instead of spending evenings shoving grated cheese into mouth and trying to avoid glugging wine, to calmly go through all clothes, giving anything that have not worn for a year to the poor, and organise everything else into mixy-matchy capsule wardrobe, so that getting dressed becomes a calm joy instead of hysterical scramble. And then we'll go for 20 minutes on exercise bike. As exercise bike is not wardrobe, obviously, but exercise bike. 9:45 p.m. Though maybe it is all right to wear navy silk dress all the time, in manner of Dalai Lama and his robes, if I could find it. Presumably Dalai Lama has several sets of robes, or on-call dry cleaner, and does not leave robes in bottom of wardrobe full of outfits he bought but does not wear from Topshop, Oasis, ASOS, Zara, etc. 9:46 p.m. Or on exercise bike. 9:50 p.m. Just went up to check on children. Mabel was asleep, hair all over her face as usual, so that her head looked back to front, and clutching saliva. Saliva is Mabel's dolly. Billy and I both think she has mixed the name up with Sabrina the Teenage Witch and Sylvanian Bunnies, but Mabel considers it to be perfect. Kissed Billy's hot little cheek, all snuggled in with Mario, Horsio and Puffles 1 and 2, at which Mabel raised her head, said, "Lovely weather we're having," then lay back down again. I watched them, touching their soft cheeks, listening to their snorty breathing. Then the fatal thought, "If only," invaded my head without warning. If only. Darkness, memories, sorrow rearing up, engulfing me like a tsunami. 10 p.m. Just rushed back downstairs to the kitchen. Worse, everything silent, forlorn, empty. If only. Stop it. Can't afford to do this. Switch on the kettle. Don't go over to the dark side. 10:01 p.m. Doorbell. Thank God. But who can it possibly be at this time of night? Plenty of fuckwits. Thursday, 18th of April, 2013. Continued. 10:45 p.m. Was Tom and Jude, both completely plastered, stumbling into the hallway giggling. "Can we use your laptop? We were just in Dirty Burger and I was trying to do Plenty Fish on my iPhone and we can't get it to download a photo from Google, so..." Jude clattered down the stairs into the kitchen in her high heels and work suit, while Tom, still dark, buff, handsome and fabulously gay, kissed me extravagantly. "Mwah! Bridget, you've lost so much weight!" He said this every time he's seen me for the last 15 years, even when I was 9 months pregnant. "Have you got any wine?" Jude yelled upstairs from the kitchen. Turns out Jude, who now practically runs the city, but has continued to translate her love of the financial roller coaster into her love life, was spotted yesterday on an internet dating site by her horrible ex, Vile Richard. "And yes," announced Tom as we clattered down to join her, "Vile fuckwit Richard, in spite of having messed this fabulous woman around in a fuckwitted, commitment-phobic manner for 100 years, then married her, then left her 10 months later, has had the nerve to send her an indignant message about being on plenty of..." "Find it, Jude, find it!" Jude fiddled confusedly with the phone. "I can't find it. Shit, he's deleted it. Can you delete your own message once you've..." "Oh, give it to me, dear." Anyway, the point is, Vile Richard sent her this insulting message, then blocked her. "So..." Tom started laughing. "So, we're going to make up a person on Plenty of Fish," finished Jude.
"Plenty of dicks, more like," snorted Tom.
"Plenty of fuckwits, more like. And then we're going to use the invented girl to torture him," said Jude. We all squeezed onto the sofa, and Jude and Tom started sifting through mugshots of 25-year-old blondes on Google Images and trying to download them onto the dating website while making up insouciant answers to the profile questions. Wished for a moment Shazza was here to rant feministically, instead of in Silicon Valley being a dot-com whiz with her, unexpectedly after years of feminism, dot-com husband.
"What kind of books does she like?" said Tom.
"Put... seriously, do you care?" said Jude. "Men love bitches, remember?" Or,
Books, what are they? I suggested. Then remembered, wait, isn't this completely against the dating rules? Number 4, use authentic, rational communication.
Yes, it's fabulously wrong and unhealthy, said Tom,
who is actually now quite a senior psychologist.
But it doesn't count with fuckwits.
Was so relieved to be rescued from the darkness tsunami, plunging myself into the creation of Revenge Girl on Plenty of Fish, that I almost forgot my news. Greenlight Productions are going to make my movie, I suddenly blurted excitedly. They stared at me gobsmacked. Then interrogation was followed by wild jubilation.
You go, girl! Toy boy screenwriter, you've got it all going on now, said Jude,
as I managed to persuade them out of the door so I could go to sleep. As Jude stumbled into the street, Tom hesitated, looking at me anxiously.
Are you okay?
Yes, I said.
I think so, it's just...
Be careful, hun, he said, suddenly sobering up into professional mode.
It's going to be a lot to take on if you're having proper meetings and deadlines and stuff.
I know, but you said I should start doing work again and be writing and...
Yes, but you're going to need some more help with the kids.
You're in a bit of a bubble right now. It's fantastic how you've turned everything round, but you're still vulnerable underneath and...
Tom!
Called Jude, who was teetering towards a taxi she'd spotted on the main road. You know where we are if you need us, Tom said. Any time, day or night. 10:50 p.m. Thinking about authentic, rational communication, have decided to call Rockster and tell him about the knits. 10:51 p.m. Though it is a bit late. 10:52 p.m. Also, unannounced switch from texting to telephonic communication with Rockster, too dramatic, giving undesirable weight and importance to whole knit issue. We'll text instead. Rockster? Very short wait.
Yes, Jonesy?
You know I said I was working tonight.
Yes, Jonesy.
There was another reason.
I know, Jonesy. You are hopeless at lying even via text. Are you having an affair with a younger man?
No, but it's equally embarrassing. It's related to your love of the natural world and its insect life.
Bedbugs?
Nearly.
Spontaneous crying starts hysterically scratching head, not knits.
Can you possibly forgive, etc.? There was a brief pause, then texting noise.
Shall I come round now?
Am in Camden. Dazzled by Rockster's cheerful gallantry, I texted back, yes. But don't you mind about the knits?
No. I've googled them. They're allergic to testosterone.
The Art of Concentration. Friday, 19th of April, 2013. 134 pounds. Calories, 3,482. Bad. Number of times checked for knits on Rockster, 3. Number of knits found on Rockster, 0. Number of insects found in Rockster's food, 27. Number of insects found in house plague, 85. Bad. Texts to Rockster, 2. Texts from Rockster, 0. Mass emails from class parents, 36. Minutes spent checking emails, 62. Minutes spent obsessing about Rockster, 360. Minutes spent deciding to prepare for film meeting, 20. Minutes spent preparing for film meeting, 0. 10:30 a.m. Right. I'm really going to get down to work on presentation of my script, which is an updating of the famous Norwegian tragedy Hedda Gabler by Anton Chekhov, only set in Queen's Park. Studied Hedda Gabler for my English literature finals at Bangor University, which unfortunately resulted in a third. But maybe all that is about to be put right. 10:32 a.m. Imperative to concentrate. 11 a.m. Just made coffee and ate remains of children's breakfast. Then started mooning about, remembering things from Rockster visit last night. Appearance of Rockster at 11:15 p.m.
gorgeous in jeans and dark sweater, eyes sparkling, grinning, holding a Waitrose shepherd's pie, 2 cans of baked beans, and a Jamaican ginger cake. The way his face looks when he's on top of me, the stubble on the beautiful jawline, the slight gap in his front teeth, which you can only see from below, those beefy, naked shoulders. Waking up sleepily in the middle of the night to feel Rockster kissing me very gently, my shoulder, my neck, my cheek, my lips, feeling his hard-on pressing against my thigh. Oh, God, he is so beautiful, and such a great kisser, and such a great... Right, must think about the feminist, pre- and anti-feminist themes in... Oh, God, though. It is so delicious. It makes me so happy, like I'm in a bubble of happiness. Right. Must get on. 11:15 a.m. Suddenly burst out laughing, remembering overblown mid-sex conversation last night.
Oh, you're so hard.
Hard because I want you, baby.
So hard.
You make me hard, baby. Then for some reason I got carried away and gasped,
you make me hard.
What? Said Rockster, bursting out laughing. We both collapsed in giggles, and then we had to start all over again. Typically, in his cheerful manner, Rockster seemed unworried by the knits, though we both agreed that in order to have responsible sex, we must knit-comb each other first. Rockster was so funny, combing my hair, pretending to find and eat the knits, whilst intermittently kissing the back of my neck. When it was my turn to knit-comb Rockster, however, did not want to draw attention to my age by putting on reading glasses, so ended up studiously knit-combing his gorgeous thick hair without being able to see anything at all. Fortunately, Rockster seemed too keen to get it over with and into the bedroom for him to notice my blindness, and was probably fine because of his testosterone. But surely it is not normal to be too vain to put on your reading glasses to knit-comb your toy boy. 11:45 a.m. Right. My script. You see, Hedda Gabler is really very relevant to the modern woman, because it is about the perils of trying to live through men. Why hasn't Rockster texted me yet? Hope it's not because of the insect incident. Rockster and I were able, unusually, to have breakfast together today, as Chloe the nanny was taking them to school. Chloe, who has been working for me since, just after it happened, is like the improved version of me. Younger, thinner, taller, nicer, better at looking after the children, and with an age-appropriate life partner called Graham. Nevertheless, consider it better that Rockster does not meet either Chloe or the children at this stage, so he hides in the bedroom until they've all gone off to school. Rockster was just happily tucking into his first bowl of muesli when he spat his mouthful out onto the table. Obviously, amused to this sort of thing, though not admittedly from Rockster. But then he held out the bowl. The muesli was jumping with tiny insects, flailing and drowning in the milk. Are they nits? I said, aghast. No, he said darkly. Weevils. Unfortunately, my response was to start giggling. Have you any idea what it's like to put a spoonful of insects in your mouth? He said. I could have died, and more importantly, so could they. Then just as he was tipping the bowl into the correct food recycling bin, he cried, ants! There was a neat line of ants coming from the basement door to the food recycling bin. When he tried to move back the curtain to get rid of them, a small cloud of moths fluttered out. Oh, it's like the 9 plagues of Egypt in here, he said. And even though he laughed and gave me a very sexy kiss in the hall, he did not say anything about impending weekend. And I have a feeling something is wrong, even if only the combined insult to his 3 great loves, insects, food, and recycling. Noon. It's noon already, and have not prepared any of my thoughts. 12:05 p.m. Still Rockster has not texted. Maybe I should text him. Clearly, in textbook terms, the gentleman should text the lady first after intercourse. But perhaps the whole socio-etiquettical system breaks down when an insect plague is involved. 12:10 p.m. Right. Hedda Gabler. 12:15 p.m. Just texted, so sorry about the 9 plagues of Egypt and for laughing. We'll have entire house and occupants fumigated for your next visit. Are you all right? 12:20 p.m. Right. Excellent. Hedda Gabler. Rockster has not replied. 12:30 p.m. Rockster has still not replied. This is not like Rockster. Maybe we'll check emails. Sometimes Rockster switches electronic mediums just to show off. Inbox is overrun not only by Ocado, ASOS, Snappy Snaps, Cotswold Holiday Cottages, links to amusing YouTube clips, offers of Mexican Viagra, save the dates for Cosmata's Build-A-Bear party, but also rash of parent mass emails over Atticus's missing shoes. Sender, Nicolette Martinez. Subject, Atticus's shoes. Atticus came home wearing Luigi's shoe, but his other shoe is also not his, nor is it labelled. I would appreciate the return of both of Atticus's shoes, both of which were clearly labelled. 12:35 p.m. Decided to join in group exchange to show solidarity and take mind off work. Sender, Bridget Billymum. Subject, re-Atticus's shoes. Just to clarify, did Atticus and Luigi go home from swimming just wearing one shoe each? 12:40 p.m. Hee hee. Have triggered funny mass email response, jokes about children coming home with no trousers, knickers, etc. Sender, Bridget Billymum. Subject, Billy's ear. Billy came home from football last night wearing only one ear. Does anyone have Billy's other ear? It was very clearly labelled, and I would appreciate its prompt return. 12:45 p.m. Tee-hee. Sender, Nicolette Martinez. Subject, re-Billy's ear. Some parents appear to think that the boys taking care of their own property and the parents clearly labelling it is a matter for amusement. It is actually important for their development as self-reliant individuals. Perhaps if it was their child's shoes which were missing, they would take a different view. 12:50 p.m. Oh, no. Oh, no. Have offended class mother and probably horrified everyone else as well. Will send direct mass apology. Sender, Bridget Billymum. Subject, Atticus's shoes, Billy's ears, etc. I'm sorry, Nicorette. I was trying to write and bored and just joking. I'm very bad. 12:55 p.m. Sender, Nicolette Martinez. Subject, Bridget Jones. Bridget, possibly the misspelling of my name was a Freudian slip. I think we all know you struggle with the occasional smoking lapse. If it was intentional, it was hurtful and rude. Perhaps we need to talk all this through with the head of pastoral care. Nicolette. Shit! I called her Nicorette. Look, don't dig yourself in further. Just leave it now and concentrate. 1:47 p.m. This is ridiculous. I'm just completely blocked. 1:48 p.m. All the class mothers hate me, and Rockster has not replied. 1:52 p.m. Slumped at kitchen table. 1:53 p.m. Look, no going over to the dark side. Grazina the cleaner will be here any second, and she can't see me like this. We'll leave a note re-insect plague and go to Starbucks. 2:16 p.m. In Starbucks now with ham and cheese panini. Right. 3:16 p.m. Huge gaggles of posh mothers with prams have taken cafe over, talking really loudly about their husbands. 3:17 p.m. Is so noisy in here. Hate people who talk on their phones in cafes. Oh, phone. Maybe Rockster. 3:30 p.m. Was Jude, clearly in meeting, whispering furtively, Bridget, vile Richard has totally fallen for Isabella. Who's Isabella? I whispered urgently back. The girl we made up on Plenty of Fish.
vile Richards fixed to have a date with her tomorrow.
But she isn't real. Exactly. She's me. He's arranged to meet me, I mean her, at the Shadow Lounge. And she's going to stand him up.
Brilliant, I whispered, as Jude said bossily. So just put a stop order of 2 million yen at 125 and wait for the quarterly profits. And then whispered, and simultaneously, the guy I met on Dating Single Doctors is meeting me, the actual me, 2 blocks away at the Soho Hotel.
Great, I said, confusedly. I know, right? Gotta go, bye.
Hope the man from Dating Single Doctors doesn't turn out to be made up by Vile Richard. 3:40 p.m. Rockster still has not texted. Cannot concentrate. I'm going home. 4 p.m. Got home to find terrifyingly pungent old lady smell. Grazina had diligently followed my scribbled instructions, thrown all the food away, cleaned and sprayed everything, and put mothballs in and behind any conceivable entry or exit to all floorboards, walls, doors, or items of furniture. Will take me all weekend, and possibly rest of life, to find and destroy all mothballs. No moth could live through this, or, crucially, Toy Boy. But that is presumably irrelevant, as still, no text. 4:15 p.m.
Yeah! There is bang, clatter and voices of everyone coming home.
It's Friday night, it's time for Chloe to leave, and have not prepared my thoughts. 4:16 p.m. How could Rockster not respond? Even though my last text was a question. Or was it? We'll just check my last text again. So sorry about the 9 plagues of Egypt and for laughing. We'll have entire house and occupants fumigated for your next visit. Are you all right? Lurched in dismay. There was not only a question, an ending of text with a question, but an undeniably presumptuous presumption that I would see Rockster again. 6 p.m. Went downstairs, attempting to conceal meltdown from Billy and Mabel, who, fortunately, as is weekend, were absorbed respectively in Plants vs. Zombies and Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2, while simultaneously heating up Spag Bog, actually Spag Cheese without Spag, as Grazina had thrown away all the pasta. Finally, when supper was over, something about loading the dishwasher made me crack and send Rockster a fraudulently cheery text saying, "It's the weekend!" Then went into paroxysms of agony, so bad that I had to let Billy just stay permanently killing plants with zombies and Mabel watching Beverly Hills Chihuahua 2 for the 7th time so they wouldn't notice. Realised was irresponsible and lazy parenting, but decided not as bad as emotional damage inflicted by awareness of melting down mother over someone closer in age to...
Yeah!
Is Rockster actually closer in age to Mabel than me? No, but I think he might be to Billy. Oh, God, what am I thinking? No wonder he stopped texting. 9:15 p.m. Still no text. Able, at last, to free fall into well of misery, insecurity, emotional pillow pulled from under feet, etc. The thing about going out with a younger man is that it makes you feel that you have miraculously turned back time. Sometimes, when we're on the chair in the bathroom and I catch sight of us in the mirror, I just can't believe this is me doing this with Rockster at my age. But now it's gone away, I have burst like a bubble. Am I just using the whole thing to block existential despair about growing old and the fear that maybe I'm going to have a stroke? And what would happen to Billy and Mabel? It was worse when they were babies. I had constant dread that I would spontaneously die in the night or fall down the stairs and no one would come and they would be left alone and end up eating me. But then, as Jude pointed out, it's better than dying alone and being eaten by an Alsatian. 9:30 p.m. Must remember what it says in Zen and the Art of Falling in Love. When he comes, we welcome. When he goes, we let him go.
Also, when Zen students sit on the cushion, they make friends with loneliness, which is different from aloneness. Loneliness is transience, and the way that people we love come into our lives and go away again, which is just part of life. Or maybe that is aloneness, and loneliness is... Still no text.
11 p.m. Cannot get to sleep. 11:15 p.m.
Oh, Mark. Mark. I know I did all this will he call, won't he call when we were going out before we were married. But even then it was different. I knew him so well. I'd known him since I was running round his parents' lawn with no clothes on. He used to have conversations with me when he was sleeping. That's when I could find out what he was really feeling inside. Mark. That dark, handsome face sleeping on the pillow. Are you lovely? Sighing in his sleep, looking sad, ashamed, shaking his head. Does your mummy love you? Very sad now, trying to say no through his sleep. Mark Darcy, the big, powerful human rights lawyer, and inside, the little damaged boy sent away to boarding school at 7. Do I love you? I'd say. And then he would smile in his sleep, happy, proud, nod his head, pull me to him, snuggle me under his arm. We knew each other inside out, back to front. Mark was a gentleman, and I trusted him completely in everything, and I went out from that safe place into the world. It was like exploring the scary underwater ocean from our safe little submarine. And now, everything is scary, and nothing will be safe again. 11:55 p.m. What am I doing? What am I doing? Why did I start all this? Why didn't I just stay as I was? Sad, lonely, workless, sexless, but at least a mother, and faithful to their... faithful to their father.
Dark Night of the Soul. Friday, 19th April, 2013. Continued. 5 years. Has it really been 5 years? To start with, it was just a question of getting through the day. Thankfully, Mabel was too little to know anything about it. But oh, the flashbacks to Billy, running all through the house saying, I lost Dada! Jeremy and Magda at the door, a policeman behind them, the look on their faces, running instinctively to the children, holding them both to me in terror.
What's wrong, Mummy? What's wrong?
Government people in the living room. Someone accidentally turning on the news. Mark's face on the television. With a caption, Mark Darcy, 1956 to 2008. The memories are a blur. Friends, family, surrounding me like a womb. Mark's lawyer friends sorting everything, the will, the death duties. Unbelievable. Like a film that was going to stop. The dreams, with Mark still in them. The mornings, waking at 5 a.m, washed clean by sleep for a split second, thinking everything was the same. Then remembering, poleaxed by pain, as though a great stake was ramming me to the bed, straight through the heart, unable to move in case I disturbed the pain and it spread, knowing that in half an hour the children would be awake and I'd be on, nappies, bottles, trying to pretend it was okay, or at least keep things together till help arrived, and I could go off and howl in the bathroom, then put some mascara on and brace up again. But the thing about having kids is... you can't go to pieces. You just have to keep going. KBO. Keep buggering on. The army of bereavement counsellors and therapists help with Billy, and later Mabel. Manageable versions of the truth. Honesty. Talking. No secrets. A secure base from which to deal with it. But for the soi-disant secure base, i.e., try not to laugh, me, it was different. The main thing I remember from those sessions was, bottom line, can you survive? There wasn't any choice. All those thoughts that crowded in, our last moment together, the feel of Mark's suit against my skin, me in my nightie, the unknowing last kiss goodbye, trying to recapture the look in his eye, the ring at the doorbell, the faces on the doorstep, the thoughts, I never, if only, they had to be blocked out. The carefully orchestrated grieving process, watched over by experts with soft voices and caring upside-down smiles, was less helpful than figuring out how to change a nappy while simultaneously microwaving a fish finger. Just keeping the ship afloat, if not exactly upright, was, I thought, 90% of the battle. Mark had everything arranged, financial details, insurance policies. We got out of the big house full of memories in Holland Park and into our little house in Chalk Farm. School fees, home, bills, income, all practical matters perfectly taken care of. No need to work now, just Mabel and Billy, my miniature Mark. All I had left of him to keep alive, and to keep me alive. A mother, a widow, putting one foot in front of the other. But inside, I was an empty shell, devastated, no longer me. By the time 4 years had gone by, however, the friends were not having it. Part 1. Born Again Virgin. 1 year ago. These are the extracts from last year's diary, starting exactly 1 year ago, 4 years after Mark died, which show how I got myself into the current mess. 2012 Diary. Thursday, 19th of April, 2012. £175. Alcohol units 4, nice. Calories 2,822. But better eating real food in club than bits of old cheese and fish fingers at home. Possibility of having or desire to have sex ever again, zero.
She has to get laid, said Talitha firmly, sipping a vodka martini and glancing alarmingly around Shoreditch House for candidates. It was one of our semi-regular evenings which Talitha, Tom and Jude insist I attend in an effort to get me out, rather like taking Granny to the seaside.
She does, said Tom. Did I tell you, I got a suite at the Cheddy in Chiang Mai for only 200 quid a night on laterooms.com. There was a junior suite for 179 on Expedia, but it didn't have a terrace. Tom, in later life, has become increasingly obsessed with boutique hotel holidays and trying to make us tailor our lifestyles to fit in with Gwyneth Paltrow's blog. Tom, shut up, murmured Jude, looking up from her iPhone, where she was on Dating Single Doctors. This is serious. We have to do something. She's become a born-again virgin. You don't understand, I said. It's a total impossibility. I don't want anyone else. And anyway, even if I did, which I don't, I'm non-viable, completely asexual, and no one will ever fancy me again, ever, ever, ever. I stared at my stomach, bulging under my black top. It was true. I had become a born-again virgin. The trouble with the modern world is that you are bombarded with images of sex and sexuality all the time. The hand on the bum on the billboard, the couples smooching on the beach in the sandals ad, real-life couples entwined in the park, condoms by the till in the chemist, a whole wonderful magical world of sex which you no longer belong to and never will again. I'm not going to fight it. It's just part of being a widow and the process of turning into a little old lady, I said melodramatically, hoping they would all immediately insist I was Penelope Cruz or Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, darling, don't be so bloody ridiculous, said Talitha, summoning the waiter for another cocktail. You probably do need to lose a bit of weight and get some Botox and do something with your hair, but...
Botox? I said indignantly. Oh, God, Jude suddenly burst out. This guy isn't a doctor. He was on Dance Lover Dating. It's the same photo. Maybe he's a doctor who's also a dance lover, and just covering all the bases, I encouraged. Jude! Shut up, said Tom. You are lost in a morass of nebulous cyber presences, most of whom don't exist, and who simply turn each other on and off randomly at will. Botox can kill you, I said darkly. It's botulism. It comes from cows.
So what? Better to die of Botox than die of loneliness because you're so wrinkly.
For God's sake, shut up, Talitha, said Tom.
Suddenly found self missing Shazza again,
and wishing she was here to say, "Will everyone fucking stop the fuck telling everyone else to shut the fuck up?"
"Yes, shut up, Talitha," said Jude. "Not everyone wants to look like a freak show."
"Darling," said Talitha, putting her hand to her brow, "I am not a freak show. Grieving apart, Bridget has lost, or shall we say, mislaid, her sense of sexual self, and it's our duty to help her relocate it." And with a toss of her lush, shining locks, Talitha settled back into her chair while the three of us stared at her silently, sucking our cocktails through our straws like 5-year-olds. Talitha burst out again. "The thing about not looking your age is, it's all about altering the signposts. The body must be forced to reject the fat positioning of middle age. Wrinkles are completely unnecessary, and a fine head of swingy, shiny, healthy hair..."
"Purchased for a pittance from impoverished Indian virgins," interjected Tom,
"however obtained and attached, is all one needs to turn back the clock."
"Talitha," said Jude, "did I actually just hear you articulate the words middle and age?"
"Anyway, I can't," I said. "Look, this really makes me very sad," said Talitha. "Women of our age..."
"Your age," muttered Jude,
"have only got themselves to blame if they brand themselves as unviable by going on and on about how they haven't had a date for 4 years. Jermaine Greer's disappearing woman must be brutally murdered and buried. One needs, for the sake of oneself and one's peers, to create an air of mysterious confidence and allure, rebranding oneself."
"Like Gwyneth Paltrow," said Tom brightly. "Gwyneth Paltrow is not our age, and she's married," said Jude.
"No, I mean I can't shag anyone," I elucidated. "It wouldn't be fair on the kids. There's too much to do, and men are very high-maintenance matters."
Talitha surveyed me sorrowfully, my customary black loose-waisted trousers and long top swathing the ruins of what was once my figure. "I mean, Talitha does have some authority to speak, having been married 3 times, and, ever since I first met her, never without some completely besotted man in tow."
"A woman has her needs," Talitha growled dramatically. "What good is a mother to her poor children if she's suffering from low self-esteem and sexual frustration? If you don't get laid soon, you will literally close up. More importantly, you will shrivel and you will become bitter."
"Anyway," I said.
"What?"
"It wouldn't be fair to Mark." There was silence for a moment. It was as if a huge wet fish had been thrown into the high-spirited mood of the evening. Later, though, Tom drunkenly followed me into the ladies, leaning against the wall for support as I flapped my hands around the designer tap trying to get it to turn on.
"Bridget," said Tom, as I started groping under the wash basin for pedals.
I looked up from under the sink.
"What?"
Tom had gone into professional mode again.
"Mark. He would want you to find someone. He wouldn't want you to stop."
"I haven't stopped," I said, straightening up with some difficulty.
"You need to work," he said. "You need to get a life. And you need someone to be with you and love you."
"I do have a life," I said gruffly, "and I don't need a man. I have the children."
"Well, if nothing else, you need someone to show you how to turn taps on." He reached over to the square tap column and turned a bit of the base, at which water started gushing out. "Have a look on Goop," he said, suddenly changing back into funny, flippant Tom. "See what Gwyneth has to say about sex and French-style parenting."
11:15 p.m. Just said goodnight to Chloe, trying to conceal slight squiffiness.
"Sorry, I'm a bit late," I mumbled sheepishly.
5 minutes, she said, wrinkling her nose kindly. "Glad you had a bit of fun." 11:45 p.m. In bed now. Tellingly, I'm wearing, instead of usual pyjamas with dogs on, which match the children's, the only vaguely sexual nightie I can still get into. Suddenly, have surge of hopeful feeling. Maybe Talitha is right. If I shrivel and become bitter,
Then what use will that be to the children? They will become child-centric, demanding king babies, and I, a negative, rasping old fool, lunging at Sherry, roaring, "Why don't you do anything for me?"
11:50 p.m. May B have been going through long dark tunnel, which there is light at the end of. Maybe someone could love me.
Is no reason why I could not bring a man back here.
I could put a hook inside bedroom door so the children wouldn't walk in on us, creating an adult, sensual world of...
Ah! Cry from Mabel.
11:52 p.m. Rushed into kids' room to see fluffy-headed figure in bottom bunk, sitting up, then quickly bending over, flatback style,
which is what she always does. She's not supposed to wake up in the night.
Mabel then sat straight up again, looked down at her pyjamas, which belched diarrhoea, opened her mouth, and was sick.
11:53 p.m. Lifted Mabel into the bath and removed PJs, trying not to retch.
11:54 p.m. Washed and dried Mabel, sat her on floor, then went to find new PJs, remove sheets, and attempt to locate clean sheets.
Midnight. Crying from kids' room.
Still carrying diarrhea sheets, diverted to room, only to hear rival crying emerging from bathroom. Considered wine. Reminded self, am responsible mother, not slapper in all bar one.
12:01 a.m.
Flapped in fugue-like state between kids' room and bathroom. Level of bathroom crying notched up. Rushed in, assuming Mabel consuming Bic razor, poison or similar, to find her pooing on the floor with expression both guilty and startled.
Overwhelmed by love for Mabel.
Picked her up. Diarrhea and sick, now not only on sheets, bath mat, Mabel, etc., but also on vaguely sexual nighty. 12:07 a.m. Went to kids' room, still holding Mabel, plus diarrhea ensemble, to find Billy out.